Hello, welcome to Power of 10, a show about design operating at many levels of Zoom, from thoughtful detail through to transformation in organizations, society, and the world. My name is Andy Pullane. I'm a design leadership coach, designer, educator, and writer. My guest today is author, speaker, and advisor Lisa Bennett, who focuses on restoring human capacity in a world of rapid change, uncertainty, and unrelenting pressure, something I think we can all recognize right now. Lisa has spent a lifetime studying what helps people rise to great challenges as an award-winning journalist, a mission-driven leader, a storyteller working closely with numerous CEOs, executive directors, and university presidents, and as a facilitator, advisor, and author who has learned firsthand from top leaders and experts. She's a former Harvard University fellow, co-author of Eco-Literate with Daniel Goleman, editor of Women Amplified, and author of the forthcoming Savor the World, Why Wonder, Not Worry Will Save Us. Lisa, welcome to Power of 10.
Thank you so much, Andy. That was a lovely introduction. Happy to be here.
So I've given it a lot away in the introduction, but tell us a little bit about yourself and your journey to where you are now.
Sure. I started out as a journalist who wanted to see the world. And early on in my career, I had one really pivotal experience, which was I had been sent out to cover a forest fire. And as I arrived at the scene, all the reporters there were briefed about the state of the fire and told that people had been ordered to evacuate, but some refused to go. And I became really fascinated with that. What could cause somebody to stay behind when they were up against real threats? And I was in my 20s, so I snuck beneath the police tape and went in search of these people. And I found this woman who was standing outside of her house with a garden hose and a kitchen broom. And she was watering down her house and she was swatting at the flames that were hitting her yard. And I was just staring at her. And then all of a sudden the fire came and it blocked my view of her, completely jumped the house because of what she had done and carried on. And this was just an incredible experience for me because I couldn't believe that, you know, this was not a firefighter. This was not somebody with an incredible background that would make you think she could react to something like that. So I became really fascinated with what allows people to rise to great challenges. And that kind of became the defining question of my life. And so I went from there to studying people who were trying to create change in the world in all kinds of ways, whether, you know, equality or protecting the environment or, economic justice, all kinds of issues, and have just interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people in search of what is it, you know, what allows us to really navigate these times of extraordinary challenge. And it just feels more relevant than ever to try to offer some of the things that I've learned along the way.
When you spoke to that woman afterwards, presumably the smoke cleared and you saw her again, what did she say?
In retrospect, I have kicked myself 100 times that I didn't like really corner her and ask her a lot. But she said one thing that I never forgot. She said, you know, my husband was, I said, how did you do what you just did? And she said, you know, my husband is at work. My children are at school. I did what I had to do. And it was so simple, you know? and I deeply believe that when we get out of our own way and feel that sense of responsibility and agency and possibility, you know, a lot more comes out of us than we think in our day-to-day lives.
Yeah. I used to live in Australia, and I know, you know, I've seen so many accounts and videos of people's houses being destroyed, and some then flukily just, you know, the fire went around it, and some of the people doing exactly what you're saying, you know, just hosing the place down. And
not advisable generally, I feel like we have to say these days. But
yes, okay, all right. But I think, yeah, well, the other thing is I always find it fascinating is that, you know, it's the classic question of like, what would you save if you knew your house was about to get burnt down? And, you know, one of the ones, I don't know what it is now, but one of the ones was photographs, right? You know, when now they're all sort of digital, but you probably would, you know, use your photographs and some documents and you know, and the pets. But there's a thing about that, which is her focus is very much, you know, it's her home, right? And so her focus is very much around the space that she immediately is in. Something's obviously very personal and important to her, literally shelter and safety. And in that moment, she's focused on, you know, that whole idea of the kind of sphere of control and, you know, the sphere of concern. Mm-hmm. She's really then in that little Venn diagram, is right in the middle there. And that's the thing she's focused on. You've talked about in your newsletter and in your book, this idea of how modern life asks us to live at an inhuman scale and what that does to our agency. So in that moment, she obviously felt great agency. Tell me a bit more about that idea there.
Yeah, you know, that really does cut to the heart of it. I think that we are living in times that really undercut our sense of agency. It, you know, for what you're honing in on right away, right? So she felt within this sphere of influence. We are exposed to so much that feels completely beyond us. And so what I've been exploring is, you know, what are the external conditions that we're all aware of, whether or not people are engaged in them as, you know, professionals or activists? And then how do those external conditions affect us internally? So what I've found is, like, if you scan what we know is going on around us, well, we know crises appear to be happening everywhere all at once. You know, we know change is happening faster than we can keep up with. We know uncertainty has become the only certainty. And we're facing really complex problems in our age that have no simple answers, right? So that's like the terrain, what people call polycrisis. And I think, you know, what is so important, or at least so fascinating to me, is to look at what does that do to us, to our sense of agency, but also to our sense of aliveness, you know? And the way I see it is that this destabilized world is actually destabilizing us, you know, that there's this constant undercurrent of overwhelm, and we're kind of forced into reactivity, right? You know, this happened. And, you know, perhaps one of the most salient things that I learned really with my work with Daniel Goleman was, you know, we are wired to care as social human beings, but we are not wired to care at this scale. We're just simply not. And so there's a shutting down that tends to happen. And I don't think that that's just about, you know, the practical decisions that people make, like, I cannot take in this much news, right? That's often a very wise action, that kind of shutting down to set your own boundaries. But the shutting down that I think is more concerning is a shutting down to a sense of possibility, you know? When we feel daunted, it becomes much more difficult to see possibility and to see how we can make a difference in our small circle. You know, none of us are going to solve the great big problems on our own.
Yeah.
But you're having a thought.
I am having a thought. One of the things is I think everyone recognizes that sense of, well, not everyone. I presume most people recognize that sense of overwhelm. And, you know, I know several people have said, oh, I just deleted all the news apps off my phone. If there's anything important, I'll hear about it. And yet there's another side of me that's like, yeah, but I want to kind of keep across events, and I don't want to just be ignorant and all that. At the same time, there's a tension there. But one of the things that strikes me always is about the, I think you've talked about this too, right? It's about the speed of things. Right? So if we had, you know, bad things are going on. I don't really believe in the whole VUCA thing, actually. Well, I can't remember. Mm-hmm. I always forget what it stands for. It's volatile, uncertain, something else. Because the world has always been really volatile and the world has always been very uncertain. But I think the speed of the communications about it is, you know, is part of the problem. I mean, I catch myself reading, you know, Trump news and stuff, and I'm like, oh, God, you know.
Sorry.
And part of why you're responsible for it, all Americans are responsible for. No, but part of it is, you know, I'm obviously concerned, and some of it does directly affect me, you know, if there's a global thing. And then a lot of the times I think, why do I care about what the president in a country I don't even live in is doing? Right. And the, in times gone past, I would have read it in the newspaper a day later, maybe. And in times before that, you know, would have found out about it days, weeks, maybe months even later, or not at all. And so there's this kind of pace of, I don't know if it's the pace of being able to digest it, if it's the sort of bombardment of it, because you don't just hear it once from one source, but you hear it all over the place, that gives that sense of overwhelm. I mean, you've looked into this, and you've looked into some of the research about it. So what have you found out?
Oh, I think there are so many factors that lead to that. You know, we are in a culture where, whether it's the news or the social media or what have you, I mean, we are steeped in too many impressions, right? And so that hooks us into a part of our brain where we're in a reactive mode. And so even that sense of taking a little bit of distance to consider whether we want to pay attention to that, you know, that window gets shrunk a bit. I think to your point about, yes, we've always lived in, you know, people have always faced great crises. People have always faced great uncertainty. Life is uncertain. Life is change. You know, we know all of that. And this is different because we are still a global economy, right? We're a global world. We are interconnected. So what the president of the United States does has an effect on a lot of people, right? So,
yeah. I mean, your sort of thesis on this, which I'd love, I'm going to do a poor summary of it, but I'd love to for you to expand on it in Save the World, is it's not sort of shutting off your attention. It's redirecting it, right? I would say in a different kind of direction. Can you talk more about about the book and what your intention behind it is?
I would love to. So, you know, in my journey of exploring how people rise to challenges and all of that, I of course tried to be one of those people as well. And so felt like I had this mantle of, you know, I'm gonna save the world in whatever little way I can. And it's interesting, I think, because it's been 56 years since that phrase came into our culture here in the United States around Earth Day, right? Save the world. And so basically, that's covered my lifetime. And, you know, many people have kind of lived with that, right? How many campaigns have there been over the years of save the whale, save the bees, save the rainforest, you know, save the oceans? And this is kind of the waters that we're swimming in, is this sense of the world needs saving, right? All these crises that we're talking about. Well, you know, we are caring people. So if we know all these bad things are going on, we do want to do something. And what I eventually learned was that led to complete depletion. What I have seen is that there's a journey that I went through and many other people go through where, you know, we sort of start out in life loving life, right? And then when you love life, whatever aspect of it is, and you see that, you know, whatever aspect it is that speaks to you, and you see that threatened or at risk in some way, whether, you know, it's a child, right? You worry about the future for the child, or it's a part of the natural world you love, or it's a sense of principles, you know, about how you think life should be, and you see that threatened, then we tend to go into this, what are we going to do? How are we going to try to save that thing that we love or that person that we love? And so I became completely obsessed with it when I had young children, and I became hooked by the threats of climate change. And I thought, I am going to do everything possible because this is the most important thing I can do, is try to do everything I can so that I'm not, leaving my children this world as it is. And of course, it didn't work.
You didn't save the world.
I did not. Wow. And you know, in retrospect, I saw how delusional that was, but it led, you know, it really led to a sense of depletion. And so ultimately I came to this place of realizing that if I accepted that things were as they were, you know, and I wasn't always fighting it, I had a different experience of relating to all of these issues. And I think the how we relate to all these issues is so important. So my light bulb moment was, there was a quote by E.B. White that had long, long spoken to me, where he wrote, he didn't write it, he said it in an interview in 1969, also tumultuous times, where he said, you know, I arise in the morning torn between a desire to save the world and to savor it. This makes it hard to plan the day. And I lived with this quote for years. And then one morning I just woke up and I thought, wait a minute, I've been focusing on the saving part. And I see where that led me. What about the savoring part? How do we lose that along the way? And what happens when we reconnect with it? And so that's the focus of my work. That's what I'm really, really excited about now, because as you said, it's, you know, it's about bringing that back in, right? It's changing the balance of how we look at things. So if we are bombarded with bad news all the time, I think it is on us to counter that so that we are not simply left depleted.
So this feels like a practice, you know, and I can see the relationship between Zen and mindfulness and all of those things. How does it work in practice for you? Can you give me an example of the kind of thing that you would do?
Sure. So, I mean, a lot of it is really simple. And it's funny, I feel like some people come to this idea of savoring the world, which I think we should define, right? Because there is a body of research about it. And it's really about pausing, right? It's about creating a bit of space for that which is good, that which, you know, replenishes us. It grew out of a body of research where the idea was, you know, Fred Bryant, who is an emeritus professor at Loyola University, was interested in depression. And so he started studying coping, and coping as a counter to depression. But that only gets you, what he realized was that only gets you to a baseline, right? It doesn't elevate things. And what elevates things is the savoring. It's, you know, connecting to those feelings of appreciation. And there are many ways that this can be done. I walk my dog every morning in the woods, and I have tried recently to start putting words to it. Like, I pull out my phone and I try to capture what I'm feeling. And there's something about just giving ourselves space, you know, and looking at, it sounds so silly, it sounds so hokey. And I think that's why some people avoid this kind of topic. But, you know, look, I walk past this stream where beavers have been creating new waterways, and I've seen how that's evolved over the years, and I love it, you know? And so just creating space for that kind of experience. There are a million different ways, but that's one I experience every morning.
I get the sense, tell me if I'm wrong about this, I'm reading this, when you say, oh, you know, it sounds so hokey, but I get the sense almost a little bit of an embarrassment about this, that this is kind of, what's behind this? Because I can hear it and I think, you know, I completely understand it, but I'm not just sort of pinning it on you personally, but I think everyone has a bit of a, if you said, well, what did you do today? I go, well, you know what? I went for a walk and I sat down in the grass and watched some ants and sniffed the flowers. You know, there would be, sometimes I think there's a bit of an embarrassment about that. What do you think is going on there?
Yeah. Well, boy, that's a toughie. And you definitely picked up on something. It's been a real journey for me because you know, there is a way in which, especially if you are in the world of caring about these big issues that are threatening to people and to nature and, you know, to the principles of equality, and you start talking about things like this, people can very easily think, oh my goodness, you're being so naive, you're distracting yourself from what's really going on. We don't have time to go look at the beavers, you know, come on. And there very much is that sense among people who work in these fields, I think. So there's been a process for me of needing to give myself permission and hoping to spread that to others so that they feel permission to do this. I think, you know, I can hear when I was a child, my father saying, "Stop and smell the roses." And I thought, oh, my God.
So embarrassing,
what is this man talking about? You know, it just awful. But, you know, cliches don't help, right? Mm. But the experience, it's not just about capacity, right? Capacity is incredibly important, and savoring as the fuel for capacity, but it's our birthright to enjoy our lives and to appreciate it. And I firmly believe that it's our birthright to savor the world. And that, you know, when we live in these times in which we're so relentlessly exposed to the challenges, it can be easy to forget that we are passing through. We are passing through. We are one person among how many billion now, right? I think that the humility piece is really important in this, so that we are not carrying everything on our shoulders and we're not missing out on, you know, our wild, precious lives.
Yeah, no, very much so. It reminds me of a piece of work one of my students is doing, actually, Tatiana. I'll put the links in the notes. And she's created this thing, it's called Von Wegen Natur Lab, and it's really about, it all started off about sort of mental health, actually, and about sort of creating these sometimes they're sort of tasks, sometimes they're a guide to in nature, in the forest or wherever, to do exactly that, to just stop and listen, and what sounds can I hear, what smells can I hear, and what can I see if I really stop and look, and all that. As a kind of mental reset. She's got a whole bunch of really nice little videos she started doing, actually, on LinkedIn too. There's a thing that strikes me about this. We were talking about this idea of agency at the beginning, and the woman with her house, and there's this expression of shouting at the wind, right? There's some things you just can't control, and you're shouting at the wind just you know, gets you irate, but the wind doesn't care. And part of me, I really like that. I use it often in my coaching practice and talking to people about this, where they get really irritated about something that's just outside of their control, and they spend a lot of energy on that. And often at the expense of the things that are in their control. And that seems to be a sort of important extra to that, because, you know, the woman who saved her house is kind of shouting at the fire, right, on the one hand, but actually she's sort of doing something that's within her control and ultimately saved her house. It strikes me that there's a part of the message is, you know, we deplete ourselves and use our energy up on a whole bunch of stuff that is overwhelming and we're seeing in the world, and you know, we're trying to save the world. And because we deplete ourselves, we don't have the energy to tend to the things closer within our hearth and home. Right?
Beautifully put.
But also there is a thing there, certainly a thing I think I've learned through teaching, and probably you have through your work as a writer and a journalist, is that there's also a ripple effect aspect to this that feels to me quite important, that you're not just, it's not just, well, I'm, you know, pull the ladder up, I'm okay, I've got my, you know, because that's the sort of billionaire bunker, right? Doomsday bunker thing. There's something else about having created that space for yourself, that it does have an effect on other people. It's not just a kind of selfish act.
100%. I think, yeah, the whole idea of ripple effects is a big one. And it was my, as I mentioned, you know, I started focusing on a lot of these issues as a parent of young children and caring about the world from that perspective, right? And so what I see in retrospect is that I went way out there, you know, trying to control what I couldn't actually control to the extent I thought I could. And that in these times, I think it is so profoundly important what effect we have on people in our circle. And the research, of course, shows that people are more influenced by people in their circle than they are, right, by folks on the world stage. And so how we navigate these times, I think, is really important. Not just what do we do, but what is the sense of presence that we bring to it. And, you know, part of this work that I'm exploring is trying to really give a little sense of perspective, right? So that if we're kind of caught in this story of the world needs saving, and we consider that maybe that's not why we're here, right? You know, maybe we are here to savor the world, and that then leads to a more natural, balanced way of doing what we can to protect the people and places we love. And on that, the research is new, but it is encouraging. And I think, you know, the way I think about it is that ultimately we save what we savor.
Mm. Well, yeah, okay. Very true. Yeah. And so in this time, I mean, certainly in my field, there's my big complaint is, you know, speed is just goes unquestioned, right? So in a lot of designers complain about the fact, or researchers complain about the fact that they're not really getting the time to sit and think and think through the stuff. The pressure from the business is always fast, you know, go as fast as possible. Because it's a sort of unquestioned good thing. And whereas I really question it, I think, because it's obviously very easy to be run very fast in the wrong direction. You very quickly find yourself a long way into the wrong place, right? If you've ever, I mean, it's like whether it's running, it's usually driving, right? If you're ever driving too fast, not paying attention, and you're, you know, on the highway and you overshoot your exit, it's like, oh, now I've got to drive a whole, until I get to the next exit. And then I've got to kind of go back and all of that stuff. And it feels to me that we're doing that all the time. And I think it does say a lot about what we care about. And I'm interested, because it's so current at the moment, on your take on, I don't even want to say it, but on your take on AI, because obviously there's a thing there which is, I mean, it has many levels of there are obviously interesting things about it too, and but there's many levels of kind of issues with it. But one of the things is that on the macro level, you know, people like Sam Altman are saying this is going to change humanity and this is the biggest thing ever, and we're the company to do it, so please give us billions of dollars. But on the sort of person to person level, it also seems to be eroding a kind of trust and connection, because, you know, I've had a few things where I've had an email from someone, I've read something, I'm like, oh, this has been not entirely written by you, or it's not at all been written by you. And there is a erosion of kind of personal trust there that goes on. And I'm really interested in your take about that, because it feels like, my take is, it feels like that you're saying, not you're saying, it feels like the people are saying, I'm sending you this piece of text and I couldn't really be bothered to write it, and so therefore I do not savor our relationship enough to actually, you know, I don't care enough about you to write something. Or at least, you know, my time is more important than yours.
Yeah.
And I wonder what your take on sort of AI just in general is, because it feels to me a cloud over what you're talking about too, right? That we're all living under the shadow of.
I wish I could say I disagreed, but I am not aware of having received any emails from people I know that were written by AI. If I had or have in the future, oh my goodness, that would be awful. On the other hand, I have heard of people who had troubled relationships with family members, and, you know, some of whom used AI to help them communicate better, and it's improved the relationship.
Heard this too, actually.
So I think, I do think that's interesting. I think my biggest concern personally about AI is that it takes us further along the road of not thinking things through for ourselves. Yeah. And there is so much delight in figuring things out and really figuring out what we think and feel and believe, and not, as you say, just getting caught up in the speed, in this case, of quick answer, and then it's forgotten.
It's interesting, that point. I'm really glad you made that point about the people using it to sort of modulate their communications with in difficult relationships, because I think one of the things is it kind of slows, it makes it less reactive, right? That you don't immediately just fire back a kind of irritated message and sort of escalate things. And so there's a thing there where it kind of slows you down by virtue of you having to go through the AI loop in order to do it. Mm-hmm. And presumably you also learn new communication styles and what works and what doesn't through it. I mean, I slightly fear that everyone starts talking to each other in a certain style, because obviously it kind of squashes towards the sort of middle ground. And suddenly, you know, you look on LinkedIn, and I mean, there's some stuff that's just copy and pasted, but I also see stuff that people have obviously written by hand, you know, human by hand, but they've started to take on the tics of that stuff too. But I'm kind of fascinated by that idea of our sensibility to human communication, really, I guess. There's the sort of, I keep likening it to the moment where, you don't really get it now because they get rid of it, but there used to be in older movies and TV shows that thing where the boom mic just came in at the top of the frame, you know, on a shot, and they obviously decided they needed the shot and they left it in. But in those moments, you're pulled out of your suspension, your willing suspension of disbelief, right? And you're like, oh, yeah, no, this is just actors and this is just a set. And I'm trying to think what it does the same for me. I'm trying to think what the suspension of disbelief is, or what is it that I'm believing in that little moment ruins for me when I see a signature of an LLM in a piece of communication. I don't have an answer to it.
Is it just desire for authenticity?
Maybe. One of the things that I've been thinking about quite a lot was this idea of being depleted. And, you know, in my world, again, in the sort of service design world, there's a whole thing around a lot of organizational change happens when, and it's usually triggered by some technology change, right? There's a big kind of new technology in, I mean, AI is obviously the one at the moment, but it's just one of many over the years. And there's loads of research that those transformations fail. And my high percentage, I can't remember off the top of my head, but it's like in over 80%, I think, of those transformations fail when the humans in those transformations are not taken account of. And there's this whole idea of transformation fatigue too, which is, you know, because often CEO tenures are pretty short. The staff who work there just get depleted and depleted. When people are in there, daily work, and I guess this is probably plugging into my coaching experience, you know, part of it, they can't always just go out and sniff the flowers in the forest, right? I'm being facetious, that makes it sound like really bad. How can they, in their sort of everyday work life, savor their world as well?
Well, you know, I have to say I am very influenced by Zen teachings in my work, and I saw you just have a sip of coffee or tea or water or something there. Right? It is late in your day. And, you know, it's one of those things where Zen teachers would say, savor your cup of tea, you know, savor 5 minutes, a 5 minute break, savor taking a few minutes before getting to the business of a meeting to really genuinely connect with someone. Savor commitment to pick up the phone and talk to somebody you love for 10 minutes out of your day. You know, I know people who stop at noon every day and will meditate for 15 minutes. You know, you can close your door and do that if you have a door, or so many people working at home. And I will be the first person to say that is really hard to do. You know, when you get in the midst of the working rhythm, it is really hard to pause. Like once upon a time, people took scheduled breaks, right? I don't know anybody who does that anymore. But there's this reset that is so important that happens. I mean, I meditate for a brief time most mornings, and how I feel before and after is really, really different. The capacity that I bring because I have taken just a little bit of time to pause. I see things differently. I feel differently. I'm less caught up in being reactive. And so there is this way to go back to what you said earlier about, like, is there a certain sense of embarrassment or something about all of this? You know, I am very painfully aware that people in organizations can think that something like this is all a nice to have. But I do not believe this is a nice to have. I deeply believe it's essential because we know people are burning out like crazy, right? So I think, you know, weaving this kind of theme and practices into the culture of workplaces is what sustains us.
Yeah, I totally agree. There's a guy called Stuart Brown. He's done a lot of research and work on play. And my PhD was about this. And he said, you know, the opposite of play is not work, it's depression. And, you know, listening to you talking about it, it seems like we have got ourselves into a state where we are embarrassed to be a human instead of a machine. That's a very sad state of affairs.
Yes. Can I ask you a question? How does this fit in your life? How do you relate to this theme? And do you practice it?
Yeah, I think there's a few things. One is, for me, I've always been a bit like this, and I've always tried to enjoy the details. And I don't know if I'm ADHD or not, but I think that people who kind of, a lot of people in design have an eye for tiny little details and often appreciate it, often get frustrated by it as well. The worst thing is getting into an elevator with a bunch of designers who immediately start complaining about the buttons and stuff. I have a dog, I have a dachshund, and walking with him every day is something that, because I often take the same route. I think that's one of those things where I see, and I live in a fruit-growing region, so there's lots of apple trees and cherry trees. It's been a very lovely kind of few weeks recently because they've all been in blossom. But I notice the season changing, and I notice the you know, a field that I walk past, and then, oh, there are the little green shoots. And at some point, it's like the corn is really high, or the, you know, the trees are laden with fruit. And that is quite so meditative for me. I think one of the important things is taking that same path and seeing over the course of days and weeks the seasonal changes. I think that's one of the ways I do it. One of the things that struck me as you were talking before about things at work is my colleague, actually, Daniela Castellanotto. He's really good at appreciating other people and saying it. And I think that can be a very healthy thing too, is actually take the focus off yourself and say, oh, you know, Lisa, that thing you did, I thought that was really great. Or you're really good at this thing in a genuine way, not in that kind of awful kind of corporate way.
That's key. Yes.
can be a really nice thing to do too. And that's perhaps where some of that ripple effect comes in.
Yeah. And I wrote a piece not long ago about savoring as a leadership quality for Big Think magazine. And yeah, I mean, that people who can genuinely see the potential in somebody else or the, you know, the gifts of somebody else, it's hard for me to think of something that's a more motivating quality in a leader than that.
Right? That's a nice thing to end on because we've come up for time. But there is one final question. The show is named Power of 10 after this Eames film about Powers of 10, about the relative size of things in the universe. And it's all about the kind of cadence of lots of space and then lots of stuff and lots of space, regardless of which kind of level of zoom, whether you're microscopic or out in space. And so the last question is always, what one small thing is either overlooked or could be redesigned that would have an outsized effect on the world?
Change our story. It's not one small thing, but, you know, if we put the weight down of the sense that the world needs saving and recognize that our birthright, to go back to that, is to savor the world, I think we have a much better chance of saving it.
It's just interesting, the recent, you know, NASA fly around the moon, they really did savor the world, right, in that moment. Yeah, the whole of it.
And look at the impact that that had on people, you know.
It really did. It really resonated with people enormously. So when does the book come out?
End of the year, November, hopefully.
Okay. And where can people find you online?
At lisabennettwrites.com, and I'm also on Substack, Save of the World.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Andy.
For being my guest on Power of Ten.
What a pleasure. Thank you so much.
You have been watching and listening to Power of Ten. You can find more about the show on palaine.com, where you can also check out my leadership coaching practice, online courses, as well as sign up for my irregular newsletter, Doctor's Note. If you have any thoughts, please put them in the comments or get in touch. You'll find me as Andy Palaine on Blue Sky, LinkedIn, YouTube, or my website. All the links are in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.